This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Jessica Mazaros. Later this hour, we'll meet the fifth grader who's playing Helen Keller in Florida Repertory Theater's current production, The Miracle Worker. Liza Jane Longenhagen first took to the Florida Rep stage earlier this year as Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird. But first, next Monday, February 26, more than two dozen thought leaders from around the world will gather in Naples for the 2018 Imagine Solutions Conference. It brings together private sector leaders to explore some of the world's most relevant issues with an eye on ways to implement solutions at a local level. We're joined for the first part of today's show by one of the event's featured speakers. Bradley Miles is executive director and CEO of Polaris. The global nonprofit is combating human trafficking, also called modern-day slavery. Experts say Florida is third in the nation for the human selling business right now, and our listening area tops the state. Thank you for joining us, Bradley Miles.
Thanks for having me.
Miles has been working on this issue for about a decade in all 50 states. So if you listening out there want to ask him a question, or if you want to share a trafficking story with us, call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can find us on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. So Bradley Miles, first, can you define human trafficking for those who may not understand what it is? Like, for example, prostitution versus a trafficking situation?
Sure. We're talking about kids who are involved in the sex trade, adults who are 18 or over who are in the sex trade, but they're there from violence or threats or coercion, and anybody, adult or child, who's involved in some sort of labor, some sort of service industry by force, fraud, or coercion. Those are the three major buckets of human trafficking.
And how would you describe the human trafficking situation in the nation right now?
I think that we operate the National Human Trafficking Hotline, so we're getting calls every day. We have a very daily look at how this problem is manifesting, and
Right. We
know that this is real. We know that it's a myth that it only happens in other countries. We know that it's much bigger than the average citizen realizes. And we know that it's much closer to home. It's in all 50 states. It's in the majority of U.S. communities. And it's certainly in Florida. And we think that people just aren't really making the connection of how close their lives might be to this.
And you mentioned Florida. Do we know, do you have any information on where Florida falls into that? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, experts have told me that we're third in the nation and that Southwest Florida, our listening area, is number one in the state. What else, do you have any other information for us about what Florida is like regarding human trafficking?
Well, Polaris says we've worked on about 40,000 cases of human trafficking. About almost 3,000 of those have come from Florida.
Wow.
So learning about those 3,000 cases, that right there shows how big the issue is. But that's only the tip of the iceberg, because it's only the cases that we're learning about through the hotline.
Exactly.
I'd say comfortably that Florida is in the top five. I think California, Texas, New York are also major hotbeds. But Florida has so many different industries, so many different sub-geographies and different types that exist there in Florida. I think it's safe to say that the full gamut of human trafficking exists there in Florida.
I'm wondering if it's more prevalent in cities or in rural areas, because I'm just wondering what you're finding with your research.
Well, I think it depends on the type. We found 25 major types of trafficking that exist in the United States based on working the national hotline. So we know that almost any case that comes into us, it'll fit one of 25 fact patterns. Some of those types of trafficking are more prevalent in cities where there's a concentration of people, maybe trafficking in illicit massage businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Others of those types might be more prevalent in certain rural areas, like certain types of farm work or other types of animal husbandry and working with animals.
Mm-hmm.
So it depends on the type. But what's, I think, striking is that different types of human trafficking really exist all across different geographies of America.
And a personal question for you. When and how did you first learn about human trafficking?
Yeah, I first learned about it in 2002. I had just graduated from college. I was shocked that I didn't learn about this in 4 years of college. And then from a group of colleagues, we started reading some news articles and began to learn about it. experience the same thing we all experience, which is just total shock that this is happening in modern day America, and then wanted to learn more and saw how layered and complex and dynamic the issue is.
And at what point did you decide that this was something you wanted to get involved in?
Pretty much immediately. I mean, I was passionate about violence against women at the time, so I was working on domestic violence and sexual assault, but major parts of human trafficking victimize women. So this is kind of violence against women plus the profit incentive of turning that into a business. So I was immediately very compelled to want to work on the issue. Started volunteering, started researching it, and then joined Polaris in 2004 and have been at Polaris for the past 13 years or so.
In your years of hands-on experience, have you seen human trafficking change?
In lots of ways, yes. Trafficking is a very dynamic crime. So the traffickers are masters of adaptation. They don't do the same thing over and over again every day. So if they're doing it one way and the community responds, they'll immediately pivot and do something different. So we're seeing
When you say the community responds, do you mean in a negative way, or I mean in a way that would negatively harm their business, or do you mean aware?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when more people become aware, I mean, think of trafficking as an opportunistic crime where traffickers perceive very high profit and very low risk. And so what we're all trying to do is we're trying to decrease their profits and increase their risk. So community awareness increases their risk. Law enforcement focusing on this more increases the risk to traffickers. So then traffickers pivot and they try to do things differently. So maybe they'll use prepaid gift cards to try to pay for certain things. Maybe they'll try to hide behind certain shell companies and fake businesses. Maybe if they're a transnational trafficker, they'll try to fake their way into the country on a legitimate visa, like a guest worker visa. But then once they get here, they start abusing that visa and forcing the person to work. So the traffickers are constantly changing, and we have to assume that they're always changing the way they do their business so that we could get smarter in how to fight it.
And how has social media changed the human trafficking industry? Because I imagine in 2002, when you first started looking into this, social media was a different kind of a bear, right? It's not what it is now.
Sure. Sure, absolutely. Well, I think social media, it's a double-edged sword. The good guys use it. So family members use it to track down daughters and sons that have been trafficked, and we've seen some really amazing stories of people being discovered and found and liberated from a trafficking situation on social media. We also know that the traffickers use it, and the traffickers use it to recruit and to advertise and to try to get more people. There's a case right outside Washington, D.C., of a trafficker posting to hundreds of high school girls on social media saying, come meet me at the mall, and you're cute. And the girls that met that trafficker at the mall got forced into the sex trade by a gang. And so social media can really help the traffickers recruit, but it could also help family members and help identify new cases. So we are really excited to be partnering with groups like Facebook and others as they get smarter about how to be part of the solution. And so I think social media could be a huge tool for good, but we have to limit the ways that traffickers are able to use social media and get away with it.
And you mentioned the traffickers and malls. Can you describe the people who are doing the trafficking? I've heard about Romeos, you know, handsome boys who lure young women into what they think are loving relationships. But in reality, that's just the way they recruit these minors. And I've also heard the word enforcers. What do these names mean?
Yeah, well, traffickers, they have lots of different tactics. Some traffickers focus more on force and violence. This concept of guerrilla pimp, they much more violent and try to really control the person into submission with violence. Other traffickers try to kind of finesse their way in through false affection and Romeo and kind of the lover boy approach. There are other types of traffickers that pose as modeling agents, and And, you know, do you want to join a modeling business? And look how pretty you are and how much money you can make modeling. So sometimes it's the promise of money. Sometimes it's the promise of love. Or sometimes it's straight fear that different traffickers try to really leverage. And different traffickers do it different ways. So it subdivides based on the 25 types of which traffickers do it which way.
Yeah, I've also heard that there's some sometimes blackmailing involved, like if a young woman uses Snapchat or posts a sexy picture on social media, that they, you know, the trafficker might say, hey, I'm going to show this to your parents, but I won't, you know, if, you know, and stuff like that. There's a blackmail sometimes involved with these vulnerable young women, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that any leverage a trafficker can get over someone, you know, hey, we have this picture of you in this compromising place, and now we're going to blast it to your whole high school, or we're going to send it to your family. Traffickers are looking for any way in to seize on someone's vulnerability or someone's something that they do that they could hold over their head, whether or not it's all threatening your kids. So lots of trafficking victims are actually mothers.
Oh, really?
And the traffickers are trying to victimize the children and use the children as the way of controlling the mother. A lot of women inside illicit massage businesses, actually, Korean and Chinese women who sometimes are coerced into the sex trade, they're moms. And so the traffickers use leverage over the kids to keep the women in that situation. So what's so sick about trafficking is trafficking takes advantage of people who are already vulnerable, and it figures out ways to make money off of them and turn that into a business and kick someone when they're down. So we really, when you look at victims all across the country who ends up being trafficked, they tend to have some form of vulnerability that traffickers have figured out how to leverage and take advantage of.
Yeah, you've actually segued into what was going to be my next question. You've kind of answered it, but I was going to ask you to describe the victims that you work with, and I was going to ask if there was a common theme as to how they become trafficked, but it seems to be vulnerability, right?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, well, one thing to know about the victims is the victims span ages, genders, nationalities. In the U.S., for example, there are victims who are born and bred in the United States. There are victims who come from other countries who are brought here across the border by criminal networks. There's adults, there's kids, there's boys, there's girls. Pretty much every way you slice it, there's different types of victims in the U.S. But what we do see, you're right, is that threat of vulnerability. So what made that person vulnerable? Maybe they're vulnerable because they were abused as a child and they were fleeing an abusive home. Maybe they're vulnerable because their family owes a ton of debt and traffickers promised them a get-rich-quick scheme. Maybe they're vulnerable because they were looking for a job and someone said, you know, pay me $10,000, I'll help you get a job. And then that person went into debt to get that job, and then that person started charging interest on the debt. Maybe the person was vulnerable because they had a really low self-esteem. And the trafficker said, you know, you're really beautiful. Has anyone ever taken an interest in you? And kind of appealed to that person's loneliness. So there's so many different types of vulnerability. We see LGBTQ youth who've run away being a particular vulnerability.
Really?
Really,
I hadn't heard that. That's interesting. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, when you look at percentages of runaway and homeless kids across America, mm-hmm. LGBTQ youth are very disproportionately represented in that runaway and homeless population. Maybe they come out to their parents and say that they're gay and their parents don't accept that and kick them out of the house, or some other reason that they became homeless. So that's the thread. When you say, you know, who are these women that ended up in these illicit massage businesses trafficked, there's something that made them more vulnerable than the average person, right? Who are the people that are under the control of a pimp and being forced into the sex trade on Backpage and in hotels? There's something that made them more vulnerable than the average person. So trafficking doesn't necessarily really happen to anybody. It's more likely to happen to the people who are the most vulnerable. Maybe kids in the foster care system, kids who've grown up with abuse, kids who've run away from home. Those are the folks that pimps are really targeting.
Is there any particular person, victim you've worked with who has stuck with you, their story?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are dozens and dozens. I think that some of the very first cases that Polaris worked on were women forced into the basements of homes in residential brothels, and they're being victimized by local gangs. And when they tried to escape, they were beaten. And we got a tip that they're being held in these basements of these local homes and in suburban neighborhoods that people might not suspect. And finally, a Good Samaritan figured out a way to get them out and brought them to the Polaris office. So so many different stories that we've been able to help. I think Polaris has probably helped over 30,000 victims of trafficking now over the past 15 years. By connecting them to help and giving them the national hotline number to call so that when they're stuck in this situation, if they could get their hands on the phone, they can text us, they could call us, and we're awake 24/7 taking those calls all across the country. And that's how people are getting out in the modern day, is they're making a phone call. And the national hotline is connecting them to services, and then they're figuring out how to get away from their trafficker and get connected into the helping hands of a local organization. And there's some amazing organizations there in Florida that are doing this work that Polaris partners with, so that we refer cases from the national hotline to them, and they're then the boots on the ground that directly work with the victims.
Yeah, we've actually spoken to some of those organizations during January Human Trafficking Awareness Month. I want to remind our listeners that WGCU has spoken to a couple local survivors of human trafficking. You can find those conversations from a previous Gulf Coast Live segment at gulfcoastlive.org, where we are discussing human trafficking trends from local to global. During this part of today's show, you can join our conversation by calling 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Bradley Miles, Executive Director and CEO of Polaris, what's a common misconception of human trafficking in your experience? Like, what are Americans not understanding about this issue?
Great question. We face that every day. I think a big one is trafficking can be more subtle than physical force. So a lot of people, when they hear about human trafficking and hear about someone being enslaved, they immediately think of violence, whips and chains, and, you know, someone being like duct taped to a bed or something like that, right? They don't realize that someone can be trafficked entirely through lies and coercion and false promises and debt bondage, for example, where the debt grows faster than the person can ever pay it off. So they feel like they're stuck in the situation, even though no one's ever laid a finger on them. So it's a misconception to think that force or violence is required for a trafficking situation. There's a lot more subtle means. I think the other big misconception is that trafficking only happens to immigrants. And they're imagining, you know, well, where did the person come from? Did they come from India? Did they come from Cambodia? And they don't necessarily think of the local girl who grew up in foster care, who grew up in America, was born in America, could be trafficked as well. So there's this misconception that trafficking requires border crossing, which it certainly doesn't. And then I think the other big one is that people really more often think about sex trafficking than they do about labor trafficking, even though labor trafficking is probably the largest form in the United States, as well as definitely the largest form in the world. So people gravitate towards talking about pimps and massage businesses and brothels and Backpage, but they don't talk enough about domestic workers in homes who are being abused, carnival workers, farm workers, people in landscaping who are mowing lawns and golf courses and other things like that, people working in elder care homes, late night janitors. There are so many different types of labor trafficking that's happening, but they're getting under-identified because people aren't thinking about it enough. So I think if people could really recognize this is broader than just violence, it's sex and labor, and it's U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, that's a much more comprehensive way to think about the issue.
What can everyday people do? I mean, not even advocates, but people listening right now, what can they do to help in these situations, not just sex trafficking victims, but labor victims as well?
But labor, too. Yeah, I mean, well, everybody are the eyes and ears of how to identify these cases. So I would encourage everyone to know the national hotline number. It's 1-888-373-7888. So they could dial this 1-888 number. And people are calling us every day with tips. You know, maybe they're getting their nails done and they saw something weird. Maybe they're out at the dinner at a restaurant and they saw something concerning. Maybe they're living in their neighborhood and they saw a neighbor with a nanny and didn't really feel right about how the neighbor was treating that nanny.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they encountered some part of the sex trade and noticed a girl who looked very young who was in the sex trade who they thought that girl can't be more than 15, 16 years old. And then they call us with tips. We're receiving thousands of tips a year, and those mm-hmm. tips can be anonymous, they can be confidential, but I think that's one of the most important ways people could get involved, is they could play a role in identifying a case.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is people can just educate themselves and read books and watch movies and read media articles and listen to shows like this one and understand that this is one of the major human rights issues facing our world today and facing our country, and that we need everybody in the country to be talking about it and thinking about it and getting educated about it and getting involved in the effort.
I'm going to mention that number one more time. It's the National Human Trafficking Hotline. That's 1-888-373-7888. Is that correct?
Yep, 7888.
888, yes,
yeah.
Sir. And so let's talk about laws, protections and preventions. Florida recently passed a law to stop charging minors with prostitution and to also charge
right.
traffickers caught with minors as sex offenders. Is there a state that's really ahead of the game in regards to combating this in their laws?
Well, I'm very proud to say that now all 50 states have actually made human trafficking a crime. There was a time back in 2003, 2004, where only two or three states had made this a crime. Florida was in the first wave of passing some early state laws back in 2003 and 2004. So Florida has been an early mover on this issue. But we're now at a point where most states have made this a crime. Most states are doing things like posting the national hotline number in their laws. Most states are not charging minors who are in prostitution mm-hmm. as child prostitutes, but actually viewing them as victims of crime.
Mm-hmm.
If a minor can't consent to sex, I think that's a great step forward. Really, really happy to hear about that new law in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's still some room to improve on the laws. Sometimes the penalty for trafficking is uh-huh. not high enough. Sometimes the penalty for being a buyer who has sex with a minor
mm-hmm.
and buys a kid in the sex trade actually isn't strong enough.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still room to improve. I think every state could still improve their laws, but there's a better baseline now across the country.
And how are we getting any information at all about human trafficking? How do we acquire and build statistics? Because as I understand it, it's difficult to know how large this trafficking situation actually is, as we spoke earlier about.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hidden crime. And traffickers are very good at not being detected, and the crime is very difficult to study. It's much more in the shadows. But one way to study it is the data that comes out of the national hotline. So Polaris has one of the best data sets in the country on trafficking. Another way to study it is from the local nonprofits that are working on this issue and working with survivors. They have great insight. Law enforcement who's investigating these cases, the local sheriffs and local cops and FBI agents and others who work these cases become real experts because they've seen it firsthand and they're a great source of data. Survivors themselves,
mm-hmm.
you actually take the time to interview survivors and say, tell us about your experience and,
mm-hmm.
you know, tell us how you use banks or tell us how you use social media. Tell us, you know, whether or not you ever had to fly around on airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Survivors are a font of great information about trafficking and truly are experts if
right.
you ask them. And then sometimes there are research studies that come out of a local university. I know Florida Gulf Coast University is doing some great research. So it's a blend of learning from the NGOs, learning from law enforcement, learning from survivors, and learning from academics. Media stories, sometimes investigative journalists, come out with some amazing information. So put that all together and we're actually getting smarter about learning about the crime for sure.
I understand the top illegal industry in the country right now that's reported is drugs and human trafficking is second, weapons is third. But experts have told me they expect the human selling business to be number one soon. Do you agree?
I mean, it's a really important question to ask. I don't know what it would take for it to overtake drugs as number one. What I do know is that it is growing. We believe that the trafficking problem is getting worse, not better. We believe that the country has had such a sustained response to drugs over the past 20 or 30 years
mm-hmm.
with drug units and the DEA and the war on drugs and so much money invested into the fight against drugs that the fight against trafficking pales in comparison to the fight against drugs. So I've seen some statistics. I'm not sure the right one, but it basically shows that the money spent on fighting trafficking is a teeny fraction
mm-hmm.
compared to the money spent on fighting drugs.
Right.
So traffickers know that.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that they're less likely to get busted for human trafficking than they are to get busted for drug trafficking. So they're switching their game. And you've got drug dealers who are quitting dealing drugs and moving into human trafficking because they think that it's going to be less risky and they're going to be able to make more money. So that's one of the reasons why the crime is growing.
We have a question from Trina Jones on Twitter. She asks, is there evidence that the legalization and regulation of prostitution has had any effect on human sex trafficking? I think she means regulation. I'm not sure about legalization, but have these laws had any effect on to combat sex trafficking at all?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. A lot of thoughtful people are asking it. So, Trina, thank you for that question. I think a couple of things. One, I think it depends on what you mean by legalization and regulation.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean legalizing pimps? Does it mean legalizing buying? Does it mean legalizing selling sex? There's lots of different actors in the sex trade,
mm-hmm.
and some legalization makes it legal for all of them. Some legalization only makes it legal for some of them. So you kind of have to distinguish between how much legalization or regulation
mm-hmm.
that are we talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But what I would say is I'm aware of one study that looked at dozens of different countries and tried to assess that very answer and came up with the finding that trafficking actually increased in countries that had legalized the sex trade, not decreased, partly because as soon as they legalized the sex trade, they legalized the process of buying sex. So a lot of guys who were wanting to buy sex, but the only thing holding them back was that it was illegal. As soon as it was legal, they went flooding into the sex trade to go mm-hmm. buy sex because now it was legal.
Right.
And with that many more buyers flooding the market, more traffickers actually went to those places where more guys were buying and started forcing women and girls into the sex trade to meet mm-hmm. the demand.
Mm-hmm.
So the legalization actually created a magnet for more demand. That increased demand created an increased demand for supply, and traffickers met that supply. So based on that one study, they were basically saying that legalization actually made it worse
mm-hmm.
for trafficking victims than made it better.
Oh, good to know. And thank you for answering that. And thank you, Trina Jones, for your question on Twitter. I want to ask you what an ideal America looks like for you in terms of eradicating human trafficking. How would our country function if we all kept human trafficking in the forefront of our minds?
That is an amazing, profound question. I mean, that is the thing that we think about all the time. I mean, I think one is that we would reduce vulnerability. So we would address challenges in the foster care system and challenges with runaway and homeless youth and not getting the funding that they need. We would actually really address the root causes of why so many people are vulnerable and who are easy prey for traffickers. I
mm-hmm.
think that's one. Two, I think we would have a really strong law enforcement response with human trafficking police units across the country and specialized FBI agents and specialized prosecutors, so law enforcement actually really have the resources they need to do their job. Three, the nonprofits that are doing this work, that are doing it on a shoestring, we'd have more shelters and more therapists and more job training programs, so we'd have a much more well-funded human trafficking response
mm-hmm.
so that there's a stronger safety net for victims. Four, I think we'd take a really hard look at sex buying in the United States, which is creating the market for sex trafficking, and how many people are buying and why. Then we'd work towards a world where fewer and fewer people were buying sex, because the more you're buying sex, the more you're creating that market for traffickers to try to make those dollars from those buyers. We'd also take a look at some of the guest worker policies that are bringing workers to the United States, and traffickers are actually using those guest worker visas. So we'd probably tighten up some controls and tighten up some policies around what it means to bring guest workers in and what type of support they get while they're here. So it would be a combination of funding, law enforcement and rule of law, social work and nonprofits, looking at kind of general societal norms and habits and looking at some key policies. And then to top it all off, we'd be learning from survivors. And survivors would be really seen as experts. And we'd ask them for their ideas about how to create a world without trafficking because they've been through it. And many survivor leaders have tons of insights to share. Put all that together, and I think we'll work towards a world with much, much less trafficking than's happening now.
Well, thank you so much for grappling that big picture question. I think you summarized it really well. My last question is, why do you do this work? What drives you every morning to wake up and keep doing this? Because I imagine it takes an emotional toll at some point.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I do this work because I'm inspired by the survivors I've met and the strength and resilience that they've shown, where they've faced things in their lives that are 100 times harder than I've ever had to deal with myself. I do this work because I truly believe that we can get rid of this from modern-day society, and we can live as Americans enjoying our lives and all the things that we love and our families. And we don't have to have this little dirty little secret that there's trafficking in our communities. I think we could actually have the win-win where we could have amazing lives without this downside of trafficking happening down the street or in that little massage business that no one really talks about. So I think that we could kind of cut the fat out of our society and actually really embrace our lives. But third, I actually think that no one really should be allowed to do this to another person. And I think it's a really, really heinous crime that someone premeditated, targeted someone, knowing that they were going to force them against their will into some form of slavery or trafficking. I think that, we can't let those folks who've done that get away with it. And we have to build a much stronger response that deters people from ever thinking that they could get away with doing that. So it's just really the social change and the systemic change that I think that we can accomplish as a society if we all put our resources and our minds together to get to a point where we build that world that we're working for that doesn't really have slavery as part of it. So I wake up in the morning and think about the hopefulness of that world.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and the work that you're doing. That's all the time that we've got for this part of today's show. I want to thank my guest, Bradley Miles. He's executive director and CEO of Polaris, a global nonprofit working to disrupt human trafficking. He'll be in Naples next Monday for the 2018 Imagine Solutions Conference. Bradley, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you for covering this. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Coming up,
Bye.
Coming up, we're going to meet two of the actors who are starring in the current production of The Miracle Worker at Florida Repertory Theater in downtown Fort Myers, as well as the show's director. I'm Jessica Mazaros, and this is Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.